This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, May 19, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Civil libertarian groups are alarmed at an expected bill from the Senate Intelligence Committee. Former Haitian Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune continues his hunger strike. And we'll take a look at immigration and the upcoming EU constitution referendum in France. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The FBI is calling extremist environmental and animal rights groups more dangerous than Al-Qaeda. Wendy Wang reports from D.C.
The Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works held a hearing with senior FBI and ATF officials yesterday to discuss violent activities by animal rights groups and environmental extremists. FBI officials claim that these organizations pose one of the most serious terrorism threats to the United States. Bo Grosskopf of the Institute for Public Accuracy, an expert on domestic terrorism.
They refuse to designate as terrorists the attacks on the family planning community. They refuse to count as terrorists groups like Wise Youth, in other words, the anti-environmental movement in this country, which David Helvarg in his War Against the Greens book documents time and time again throughout the 80s and the 90s as much more dangerous, much more violent than any of these groups ever thought of being.
He says that the FBI refuses to account for the violence done by more traditional terrorist groups, such as the individuals responsible for the 2001 anthrax attacks on the news media and members of Congress. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Wendy Wang.
The federal case against the former Florida University professor being tried on secret evidence, in accordance with the so-called Patriot Act, started jury selection this week. Lance Robson reports from WMNF in Tampa.
Ellerian's image was all over the press during last year's Florida Senate race. Although he has yet to stand trial, many of the prospective jurors admitted during questioning that they believed he was guilty. Ellerian's attorney, William Moffitt, excused as many jurors as he was allowed, but still believes Ellerian has little chance of a fair trial in the Tampa Bay area.
Is it the most biased jury panel? It is a jury panel that I believe has some preconceptions about my client before we start, and I've never really felt that way in a courtroom before.
Moffitt has requested that the case be moved out of Florida. A ruling is expected tomorrow, although the judge has indicated the trial will start on June 6th in Tampa. For WMNF Radio, this is Lance Robson for Free Speech Radio News.
More women in Ciudad Juarez have been killed. Local police blame it on domestic violence and call it a private matter. Latin America correspondent Shannon Young has more.
The discovery of the sexually abused cadavers of two girls in and near Ciudad Juarez this week has shocked and disgusted a society already familiar with a 12-year string of sex murders referred to as the femicides. The femicide victims are typically low-income teenagers with dark complexions and long hair. Their bodies are usually discovered by passers-by and all show signs of rape prior to death. Autopsies reveal asphyxiation as the most frequent cause of death. The latest victims were prepubescents. 10-year-old Anaia Rosco was found dead inside of her partially burned home while both of her parents were at work. The body of 7-year-old Iris Estrella Enriquez was discovered stuffed inside of a metal barrel after she had been reported as missing 2 weeks prior. A suspect is in custody relating to the death of the 10-year-old. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
Connecticut-based General Electric has been hit with a $450 million federal lawsuit by one of its own executives, charging he was a victim of racial discrimination at one of GE's subsidiaries. Ebon Udoma reports from Fairfield.
Mark Thomas, the chief executive officer of GE Aviation Materials, has accused the conglomerate of discriminating against him and other African-American managers and employees in pay, promotions, and perks. In a lawsuit filed in federal court in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Thomas says GE refused to promote or reward him despite his ability to deliver top sales and profits. He claims the company instead tried to push him out when he complained of discrimination. His lawsuit seeks class action status. It asks for at least $450 million in damages, as well as back pay, increases in pay, and benefits and broad changes in GE's personnel practices. GE has denied the allegations and said it would seek to have the lawsuit dismissed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ebong Udama in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Current regulations adequately protect foster children who are used in clinical drug trials, according to a Bush administration official. Donald Young with the Department of Human Services said that additional protections were unwarranted at a congressional hearing yesterday. Congressman Peter Stark of California noted that prisoners used in clinical drug trials are granted more rights than children in foster care, like having an advocate who specifically serves their needs. The hearing was in response to an Associated Press report last month that said foster children have been used in HIV/AIDS drug trials since the 1980s. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Senate business came to a standstill today as the debate on the future of the filibuster continues. Today, members of the Black Caucus as well as Black ministers gathered at the Capitol to oppose the Republican effort to eliminate the rule. Dolores Embernal reports from the Capitol.
It was a quiet day in the Capitol today. Democratic senators canceled scheduled committee meetings and stalled debates on pending bills such as CAFTA and the energy bill, while the debate of the future of the filibuster took center stage.
We have opposed the idea of filibusters and have not supported them.
Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama was among the many Republicans who defended a call to end the filibuster for judicial nominees, while blaming Democrats for using this tactic to their own advantage.
The Democrats oppose them when it's convenient and support them when it's convenient. I think their position is untenable as a matter of principle. It's untenable as a matter of public policy. Our country will not be better off for filibustering judges.
Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah joined Sessions in criticizing Democrats and defended Bush's 10 remaining judicial nominees.
If we debate these nominees, America will better understand why we need judges who will interpret, not make the law. America will see how these highly qualified judicial nominees meet that standard. And America will see that these nominees, every one of them, have a bipartisan majority support.
Meanwhile, members of the Congressional Black Caucus held a press conference today to oppose the judicial nominees, which they deem as extreme and right-wing. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton of Washington, D.C.
We oppose their confirmation to the federal judiciary because their documented views on civil and constitutional rights are so extreme that they have been discredited and rejected by most Americans. And because of their demonstrated hostility to the discipline of judicial precedent and to the laws Congress has passed to protect workers, women, persons with disabilities, and the environment.
Two white senators joined the Black Caucus, one of them Democrat Senator Charles Schumer of New York.
These are not just conservatives. These are people way over, whether it's Priscilla Owen and siding with corporate interests, or Janice Rogers Brown, who's probably the most extreme of them all. She wants to repeal child labor laws. She wants to repeal zoning laws. She said the New Deal was a socialist revolution. How many Americans, how many conservative Republicans want to go back to the 1890s?
African-American leaders of the religious community also met today to denounce Senator Bill Frist's comments that those who oppose the nominees are not Christian. Reverend Timothy McDonald is the pastor of a Baptist church in Atlanta.
The truth of the matter is that the ones who are guiding the whole process that we're now engaged in and this confirmation is the radical religious right. I take offense when people of other religious persuasions say because I don't vote the way they vote and I don't think the way they think that I have no faith and that all of those who disagree with them are not people of faith or moral values. Yes. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Senator Bill Frist was to meet with Black religious leaders who support the end of the filibuster later today, to contrast the efforts of those who support the Democrats on defending the filibuster. Reverend Amos Brown came from San Francisco. He criticized one Black judicial nominee, Janice Brown, who has voted against affirmative action and workers' rights, but yet remains a staunch Christian conservative.
She's voted against affirmative action in her pronouncements as a judge. She has been anti-poor. She's been anti-woman. We just can't take it anymore.
Dolores Bernal, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Civil libertarian groups are alarmed at an expected bill from the Senate Intelligence Committee that will make much of the Patriot Act permanent and expand surveillance and law enforcement powers that are commonly associated with what is known as the Patriot Act II. Mitch Jezrich reports from Capitol Hill.
The Senate Intelligence Committee has begun to move on the reauthorization of several expiring provisions of the Patriot Act. The committee was set to act on it today, but due to the judicial filibuster fight, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid is prohibiting all committees from meeting beyond the morning hours. Republican Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi, who serves on the Intelligence Committee, got his first briefing on the Patriot Act bill today.
There were about 16 provisions that are expiring. We're going to extend 8 of them in our bill. It has generally worked well and fairly, and I think it's critical for our law enforcement and our intelligence community, and we need to make it permanent.
According to congressional aides who briefed reporters on the bill, the measure would give the FBI new authorities to issue subpoenas that are not reviewed by a judge or jury in order to quickly obtain records and evidence. Senator Lott was apprehensive in discussing details on that provision.
I think that that might be necessary, but it does have to be in prescribed and limited circumstances.
Where does the necessity come from for it?
Well, I'd rather not get into that right now. We'll talk publicly about that next week.
Reportedly, Republican Chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Pat Roberts, will make the bill public next week.
The Senate Intelligence Committee is set to hear in secret, in a secret closed session, a bill that would make the entire Patriot Act permanent.
Timothy Edgar is a legislative counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. He says giving the FBI the ability to spy on people without a judge's approval is dangerous.
Well, what we're concerned about is that this proposal, which first circulated a couple years ago as part of Patriot Act II, would have the effect of taking the judge completely out of the picture. Right now, the administration can get all sorts of private records, like library records and medical records, by going to the secret FISA court on the basis of a rubber stamp standard. This would eliminate even that inadequate court review by allowing the FBI to get these records, any records or tangible things, without any review at all.
The new Patriot Act measure would also expand the parameters on who the FBI can wiretap to include people who have no connection to any terrorist organization. Former Assistant Attorney General Viet Dinh, who helped write the first Patriot Act, explains.
A lone terrorist, whether or not acting in concert with a known terrorist organization, poses as grave a danger on the security and safety of the American people as a terrorist working in concert with an established terrorist organization.
The White House is pushing Congress to make permanent the provisions of the Patriot Act that are set to expire by the end of the year, including Section 215, which gives authorities access to library records.
It was a fishing expedition because they asked for the names of all persons who had checked out a copy of the book since the book was added to our collection in 2001.
Joan Eroldi is the director of the Whatcom Library District in the state of Washington. She says last year the FBI requested all the names of the library patrons who checked out a biography on Osama bin Laden that contained this quote from the Al-Qaeda leader.
And that quote is, "If the things I'm doing is considered a crime, then let history be a witness that I am a criminal. Hostility toward America is a religious duty, and we hope to be rewarded by God."
Eroldi says the FBI threatened to use the Patriot Act to obtain the list, but instead used a grand jury subpoena. The FBI later dropped its demand when the library challenged it in court. Still, Eroldi says the library provision of the Patriot Act poses a threat to intellectual freedom.
He was a senior citizen, and he said that he and many people he knows have stopped checking books out on sensitive issues because of exactly what we're talking about, the fear that someone will someday come along and want to know what this person was reading.
The Senate Intelligence Committee is planning to take up the new Patriot Act bill next week. Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
In Haiti, about 5,000 supporters of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide demonstrated in the country's capital of Port-au-Prince, demanding the ousted leader's immediate return from South Africa. Meanwhile, imprisoned former Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune has been on a hunger strike for over 1 month, bringing him to the verge of death. Neptune has been accused of participating in an alleged massacre in February 2004, but nearly 11 months after turning himself in, no evidence has been presented against him, and he has yet to see a judge. Meanwhile, jailed paramilitary leader Luigi Del Champlain, who is in the same prison as Neptune, is closer than ever to being freed after the Supreme Court earlier this month overturned a jury's historic verdict that had convicted him in absentia for his role in the so-called Rabuteau massacre in 1994. Reed Lindsay reports from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Just how close is Yvonne Neptune to death? As his hunger strike enters its second month, the state of Neptune's health continues to stir controversy, in part because the government has barred journalists, including this one, from visiting him. According to a statement issued by Justice Minister Bernard Goose on Saturday, a psychiatrist who had seen Neptune on May 6 concluded that he was in relatively good health. But after visiting Neptune on Monday, U.S. Congressman Kendrick Meek referred to such assurances by the government as totally inaccurate, saying that Neptune was weak and his voice barely audible. What is certain is that Neptune is slowly approaching the end with no solution in sight. He has refused to eat until he is declared innocent and released, a demand the interim government of Prime Minister Gerard Latortue has deemed unacceptable. Meanwhile, his case remains stalled and going nowhere fast. United Nations human rights official Thierry Fagard has called the judicial proceedings in Neptune's case illegal.
It's only political persecution.
Mario Joseph is a human rights lawyer who represents Neptune as well as victims of the Rabuteau killings.
It's not just Neptune's case. They're not doing anything in many other cases. People are in illegal prolonged detention, pure and simple. In what country is this done? Nowhere else, only in Haiti, with a government that's a dictatorship. They didn't even do this under Duvalier. They're releasing criminals and detaining innocents.
Meanwhile, Louis-Joël Chamblain, former leader of a murderous paramilitary group during the 1991-1994 military dictatorship, could be released at any moment. A judge has ordered his release based on the recent Supreme Court decision that overturned a milestone verdict by a Haitian jury in November 2000. It's still not clear if and when the government will execute this order. The jury had convicted 16 former soldiers and paramilitaries for their participation in a 1994 bloody rampage through a seaside slum called Rabuteau. Another 37 were convicted in absentia. The only one in jail now is Chamblain, who helped lead a revolt of former soldiers and gangs that ousted former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February 2004 and freed all those convicted for the Rabuteau killings. Legal experts say the recent Supreme Court's decision, which stated that the case should not have been tried by a jury, was based on a technicality.
Mr. Goose, Minister of Justice, put pressure on the judicial system so that they would make a bad decision in favor of Chamberlain.
Camille Leblanc was Justice Minister from 1999 to 2001 under former President René Préval. According to Leblanc, the Supreme Court contradicted its own approval of the Rabuteau trial 5 years earlier.
Why do I say this was a political decision? Because it's the first time in Haitian history that the Supreme Court decides on a case, saying that it's correct and conforms with the law. And 5 years later, same question, same thing, same case, the Supreme Court decides that it's no longer good.
The ruling on the Rabuteau case marked the latest in a series of human rights scandals since interim Prime Minister Gerard Latortue assumed office 14 months ago. In August, Chamblain was acquitted for the 1993 murder of businessman and pro-democracy activist Antoine Ismarie, in an overnight trial that Amnesty International condemned as a very sad record in the history of Haiti. Under Latortue, the Haitian government has been accused of waging a campaign of repression against Aristide supporters that has included arbitrary arrests, illegal detentions, summary executions, and bloody crackdowns of peaceful demonstrations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Reed Lindsay from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
A diplomatic skirmish in Southeast Asia has broken out over whether Australia will be allowed to join the upcoming East Asia Summit, out of which a new regional organization may emerge. Australia has so far been barred from attending the conference, most vocally by host country Malaysia, because of its reluctance to sign the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, due to fears the move will anger the United States. Erica Vowles reports from Sydney.
The Australian government has stated that its reluctance to signing the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation is related to the country's alliance with the US. By signing the treaty, signatories agree not to use force against other members or meddle in another country's internal affairs. Alan DuPont is a visiting fellow at the Lowy Institute of International Affairs in Sydney. He explains Australia's concerns further.
The primary reason is because of US concerns that the treaty would restrict its capacity to intervene in the region, and Australia, as a loyal ally of the United States, takes the same view.
However, Dr. DuPont believes signing the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, or TAC for short, will not damage our alliance with the US.
I don't think so, and I think the proof of that is the fact that other US allies in the region, notably Japan and South Korea, have both agreed to accede to the TAC, and there's no reason at all why Australia can't do that.
The treaty has been described by observers as a motherhood statement, which is not really enforced by those signed to it, but rather is valued for its symbolism. For this reason, Sean Turnell, a senior lecturer in economics at Macquarie University and an avid observer of human rights in the Asia region, is sympathetic to Australia's reluctance to sign. However, he believes overlooking the treaty's cultural importance is having a negative impact on relations in the region for the US's most avid ally.
I think the wavering has raised a few eyebrows, and unfortunately it just goes to confirm worries that some countries may have had, or say they may have had, with things like the statement that we've made about preemption and so on. So in many ways it would confirm certain prejudices in the region.
One reason put forward by the Australian government for not signing the TAC is that it would jeopardise our ability to comment on human rights in the region. However, this attitude is seen by some as a smokescreen. Pierre Morrow is a volunteer with the Australia-Asia Worker Links, which helps to campaign for union rights in Asia.
So to say that if they sign this treaty, they will not be able to comment anymore on human rights abuses, I think is a real furphy. I think the Australian government's comments on human rights abuses only when it serves the foreign policy of whoever the Australian government is at the time.
Dr. Turnell of Macquarie University also believes the human rights argument does not hold water, especially given Australia's own record on human rights.
I'd like to see Australia be much more outspoken about human rights, but I think our record on refugees and in other matters greatly tarnishes our image.
The economic and cultural benefits from being involved in the regional grouping could be significant, and the pressure Australia is facing on the issue has intensified with news that Australia's neighbour, New Zealand, will sign the treaty. However, the Howard government's reluctance to sign highlights the concerns that many have in the region about Australia's unwillingness to identify as an Asian nation at the expense of its alliance with the US. Alan DuPont.
I think overwhelmingly the benefit of signing the treaty is to send an unambiguous signal to the Southeast Asians that we do see ourselves very much as part of this region. John Howard has underestimated the importance of symbolism in indicating where Australia's heart lies. I think he's taken too much of a business-like approach to this, and the reluctance to sign the TAC has just reinforced the view in Southeast Asia that Australia's not really committed to the region.
This is Erica Vowles in Sydney, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
If ratified, the European Union Constitutional Treaty will protect certain immigrant rights. In the meantime, national governments are doing all they can to stem the flow of immigration. While Spain has just documented some 700,000 immigrants, their status remains precarious. In France, the immigration issue is touchy, and Interior Minister Dominique de Villepin has presented a repressive proposal against undocumented immigration. There are approximately 15 million immigrants who do not have the right to vote in Europe. As Raphael Kraft reports, the new constitution does not meet the expectations of advocates of citizenship to both nationals and residents in Europe.
There have been massive regularizations of immigrants in 1981 and 1997. What were the consequences? It has provoked an indraft of immigrants, and immediately newly regularized immigrants have been replaced by new irregular immigrants. This is a general fact in Europe. So it's out of the question to proceed to a massive regularization because it does not provide any solutions.
2 weeks before the referendum on the European Constitution, Dominique de Villepin, the French Minister of Interior, presented his plan for a tougher policy on immigration. A few days earlier, Spain had regularized some 700,000 foreign workers, France 12. Those 12 people conducted a hunger strike for nearly 2 months to obtain legal papers. De Villepin's clemency had been strongly criticized by the French extreme right wing. Bahija Ben Kouka is one of the activists who has been pleading the cause of the strikers.
I think De Villepin has launched this plan in a demagogic spirit to capture the extreme right-wing electors. But we are not surprised by this speech, as it is not different from former Minister of Interior Nicolas Sarkozy. It is not this new plan that will change anything about the question of immigration, but rather a massive regularization process like what occurred in Spain and Italy.
Bahija Ben Kouka has been living in France since 1989. Although her case had been regularized in 2001, she still doesn't have a residency permit. She must obtain a temporary stamp every year. Although she has been living in France for 14 years, she won't be allowed to vote on May 29th.
I don't have the right to vote in any elections, be it municipal, presidential, or European. Nevertheless, I am part of the civil society. I am part of my district council. I am a member of the Citizenship Advisory Council of the City of Paris. I get involved. I think it is a shame, while in some other European countries, non-European immigrants have at least the right to vote in local elections.
If approved, the European Constitution wouldn't change much about Bahija's situation. Nevertheless, many activists and some politicians had hoped the issue of citizenship would be debated during the writing of the Constitution. Claire Rodier, a lawyer for French JST NGO, is one of them.
We thought that the preparation of the constitutional treaty was going to be the opportunity to invent a new citizenship to open to residents. For us, this opportunity has been missed because this issue has been kept in the background. And we have today, as we have for dozens of years, a constitution that pulls apart some 15 million people who are European without a European nationality, who remain some sort of under-citizens with whom we live every day.
Sous-citoyens à côté de, desquels on va vivre tous les jours.
A citizenship that wouldn't be linked to nationality could be a way to take the immigrants out of this category that national immigration laws have built for them throughout Europe. A disposition of the new constitution could give European citizens popular initiative. A petition containing 1 million signatures in favor of creating European citizenship for all residents will be presented to the European Commission. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Paris.
Today, May 19, would have marked Malcolm X's 80th birthday. He may be best remembered for his fiery anti-racist speeches. In 1963, Malcolm X addressed a crowd with the ballot or the bullet speech, words that are still relevant today.
The political philosophy of black nationalism only means that the black man should control the politics and the politicians in his own community. The time when white people can come in our community and get us to vote for them so that they can be our political leaders and tell us what to do and what not to do is long gone. Okay. By the same token, the time when that same white man, knowing that your eyes are too far open, can send another Negro into the community, get you and me to support him so he can use him to lead us astray, those days are long gone.
Again, that was Malcolm X from a speech delivered in New York in 1963. Malcolm X was murdered in February 1965. He would have been 80 years old today. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations KPFK in Los Angeles and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Visit our website, www.fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.